Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Busy Monday here with you, Jordana Green. Thank you for spending some time with me today. It is 11 minutes after 3 o'clock on this gorgeous, gorgeous Monday. I hope you had a fun weekend, and we have much to cover. Of course, we will be covering the very latest on the Castile settlement. We will be talking about what the Supreme Court has been up to. The Supremes have been quite busy today. We will shake that down with David Schultz at 3:30. Also, we're going beyond the headlines. Some really fascinating headlines now. Have you seen that video of that young girl that fell from a ride in upstate New York at Six Flags? Turned out it was user error. Yes, it was her fault. Check out the video on our Facebook and let's talk about it in our Beyond the Headlines segment. And before you do anything, before you fund a GoFundMe page, you need to tune in at 5:30. There is a woman who started the Go Scam Me page, and she is tracking down all the scams on the GoFundMe sites to help you. I promise she will list them all for us, and we will all be better for the information that she has. It's 3:12. The mother of Philando Castile will receive nearly $3 million in a settlement with the city of St. Anthony that has now avoided a federal wrongful death lawsuit that could have taken years to resolve. The lawyer for the Castile family, Bob Bennett, is a managing partner at Gaskins, Bennett, Burrell and Shupp, co-counsel representing the family, is joining me now to shake out this settlement. Bob Bennett, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Jordan. I appreciate it.
Now, Bob, I was surprised when I woke up to this news, because often in cases like this, settlements can come years later. I was just looking at some of the most famous ones, and they're all sad. But, for example, the Michael Brown in St. Louis. We all remember what happened in Ferguson, Missouri. A $1.5 million settlement was agreed to with his family. But, again, that happened back in 2014. So this is 3 years later. Most of these settlements take years. Also, there are actual charges filed in a civil suit. None of those things happen, Bob. Explain why it happened so quickly.
Well, we've been talking about the idea of this for a little while before the trial. And then as the trial unfolded, we, and by we, I mean representatives of the city of St. Anthony, Glenda Hatchett and myself, on behalf of Valerie Castile. And we recognized that this was at least a possibility based on the information that we had and that was fully and finally fleshed out in the trial. So an effort was made to do this at this time to avoid the federal civil rights lawsuit that may well have taken 2 to 4 years working through the federal district court and appellate court levels.
It seems also that this had to happen with full cooperation of the city of St. Anthony.
Well, it did. They have experienced counsel, Joe Flynn, who I've had many, many cases with throughout the years. And while we're adversaries, we know we can respect and trust each other. So you have to have a little of that so you don't have the dance of the negotiations being the centerpiece of this and ultimately requiring a filing of a civil lawsuit to flesh it out. This was handled by people with a lot of experience and a lot of knowledge about how these cases are handled and what they're worth, frankly.
So was this all going on behind the scenes of the criminal suit?
Not necessarily behind the scenes. I mean, we had some early talks about the idea, the possibility of it, then watched the trial unfold, and then talked about it afterwards and kind of and decided it was a good thing to do and concluded it. The tapes, the videotape confirmed my suspicion, and kind of the common thread about bad police shootings are that the officer panics. And their response is untoward and so much different than a reasonable officer. which you saw in this case. You saw it in the Highway 212 shooting that we settled recently as well. But the 212 shooting required a bunch of hard legal work, lots of depositions. This we were able to do without it. And I think the city realized that Officer Yen was not someone they wanted on the street in their uniform anymore. And that certainly helped with their analysis, I'm sure.
So does this settlement then imply wrongdoing on the part of the officer or the city?
Well, the wrongdoing's never admitted, and if you read every release document that's ever been signed, as far as I can tell, it's expressly denied. However, you wouldn't pay someone essentially $3 million if there wasn't a very deep and abiding concern about liability.
So it's never said out loud. So the Castile family is never going to hear, and I'm sorry, or this, you know, we did the wrong thing, or we screwed up. But the money is sort of the implied version of an apology.
Well, it goes beyond that. I mean, in this case, the officer was charged. That's the first thing. I mean, that never happens, not in my 41 years of practicing law in Minnesota. Second, people want to have the officer fired, the victim's family. He was fired. Third, they want the policies of the police changed. And here, the city of St. Anthony Village is working with the Department of Justice, Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services, to do just that. Mm-hmm. And fourth, you have this financial piece, the civil rights piece. So I think the family can take more away from it than just the money. And I think there's no negotiation for a formal apology, but firing Yanez and working with the Department of Justice and paying this amount of money is more than just writing a check, I think, too.
Just to expand a little bit about what you said, the city of St. Anthony has committed to making some changes in the police department. The Department of Justice Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services is going to review, is doing a voluntary review. And obviously the goal is to create some better trust between the Black community and the police department. Hopefully that will go through. So I'm glad it's not just this. It's not here's your money, everybody walks away. There is some continuing education on both sides. What will happen to Diamond Reynolds now? Is she planning to file a civil suit as well?
Well, I don't have any insight into that. She has her own attorney, and she's not part of this settlement at all. So my guess is that she will do something, but I couldn't verify that one way or the other.
And I understand that Valerie Castile and her family have plans for the money called the Philando Castile Relief Foundation. Do you have information on that?
Well, I do. That's already an operating foundation meant to help families involved with gun violence or police gun violence. Mm-hmm. It's not limited to police settings, but and they've already been involved in meal preparation and financial aid for funeral services for other things necessitated by gun violence and police violence. So that's something that's near and dear to Valerie and her daughter's thoughts on this, and I'm sure will be a vehicle for some positive things to happen in the future, as well as in the past. It's already operating, and monies have been expended, and for good purposes.
Is $3 million enough? I'm speaking, by the way, I'm sorry, I know I asked you that question, but for those listening, I'm speaking with Bob Bennett, co-counsel representing the Castile family. Is $3 million in settlement money enough?
Well, enough for what? I mean, no amount of money could ever replace Philando or any child who is lost by a parent. I mean, you know, it's sort of obscene to equate money with a person's life. So in some sense, no. In terms of analyzing verdicts and settlements in this area, as opposed to, say, the urban settings such as Baltimore, Chicago, Cleveland, I'd say this is right in the top wrongful death settlements for police misconduct in our state. which is different than, and both in terms of its racial makeup and in terms of its being kind of conservatives in liberals' clothing sometimes. But the juries are not awarding money hand over fist here and never have been, and certainly not in this, such a robust manner as you'd see in Chicago, Cleveland, and Baltimore. Mm-hmm. So I think in terms of high numbers here, it's a very reasonable number, especially given the fact that the risk is gone. You take the risk off the table, the high end risk off the table for the city, but this is certainly a reasonable certain amount and fits within the verdict and settlement framework we've seen before in Minnesota in the last 20 years.
And forgive in advance the bluntness of my next question, Bob, but how much will the family see? How much do the lawyers get?
Well, the lawyers have agreed to reduce their contingent fee, which is higher than normal, higher than you would have in a car accident case, to essentially that of a car accident case.
Which is what, like 10%, 20%, 30%?
Well, it's just usually a third, and that's what it will be.
Okay. All right, Bob Bennett, what did I not ask you? What does the public need to know?
Well, I think the public needs to know that this was a good effort by all parties to try to resolve something reasonably, which we seem to have trouble doing that in our country lately. So this is a good step, and people are. People can go on with their lives and try to do something positive and not have suffering exacerbated by long-term litigation.
Bob, thank you so much for your time and your expertise. You got it.
All right. Take care.
That was Bob Bennett, managing partner at Gaskins, Bennett, Burrell, and Shep, and also the co-counsel representing the Castile Funny. A couple more questions you might have. I probably, hopefully, have some answers. Where does the money come from? Who's paying for all of this? My phone number is 651-989-9226. Text line is 81807. We'll have just a few minutes before the bottom of the hour to address those questions. The answer is no. The people of St. Paul, St. Anthony, Minnesota are not paying the $3 million to the Castile family. Okay? No taxpayer money will be used to fund the Castile settlement. The League of Minnesota Cities Insurance Trust is a cooperative in which Minnesota cities contribute premiums to a jointly owned risk pool that is used to pay the claims. And I do believe the finite amount for each payout is $3 million. There is only $5,000 remaining in that pool, by the way, if Diamond Reynolds chooses to sue. So what if she were to file any kind of claim and win? The city's remaining $5,000 in coverage would be paid to her. Then if she won anything above and beyond that, St. Anthony would have to cover any additional money awarded. So that's how that would shake out. We don't know if she's going to file a suit. Bob Bennett is not her lawyer. He says she has her own lawyer. Someone said, I don't know what claims she could. I mean, who knows? She had a baby in the car. She could claim, future psychological damage, endangerment of a child with a shooting in the car. I'm not a lawyer. I have no idea. But I imagine a good lawyer could find some claims if Diamond Reynolds were to file a lawsuit. But we do not have word on that yet. Someone asked if they have to pay taxes on the money from the settlement. Here's what I found via Google. I am not a lawyer, nor do I even play one on the radio. If you are and know the answer to that question, 81807. But here's what I found. According to the IRS, any lawsuit settlement that proceeds go that a court awards for physical illness or injury, which death is, are non-taxable. It includes wrongful death settlements, since the damages are imposed due to a court's finding that a third party is responsible for the illness or injury that resulted in death. Now, I understand there wasn't an actual filing for this. The city and the family just came to this agreement, but I imagine that the money would fall under this same umbrella of wrongful death. So no, then I do not imagine that the family would have to pay taxes on that. Let's see. I'm looking through your texts here. So sorry about that. Looking for your texts. And seeing what the very latest is. How much the lawyers get, we address that. He says they get 30%, so they will get $1 million, and Valerie Castile will get the $2 million that is left. When he was found not guilty, why does the family receive money? I don't get it. See, I understand your text, and Bob Bennett did address that. He said, you're never going to get an apology from the police department. You're not going to get an apology from the city of St. Anthony. But what the money implies is that there was some sort of wrongdoing. It doesn't have to be proven in court. It doesn't even have to be said out loud. But that's why. So why do you get money when someone dies? Because something bad happened. And the family, I guess, according to both parties, deserve some kind of compensation. Did the law say she does? Nothing was ever filed. But St. Anthony said, yeah, the family does. So that's why. So no, we can't have a legal basis for this one just yet. But that's why she got the money. How does this compare to other police shooting settlements? As I mentioned during our segment, Michael Brown, the Ferguson, Missouri man who was shot, his family agreed to a $1.5 million settlement. Freddie Gray was in Baltimore. You remember that one? His family reached a $6.4 million settlement. Now, remember, Freddie Gray was a 25-year-old black man. He suffered a critical spine injury after he was in the back of a transport van going to the police department. He died a week later. And then another famous case, Eric Garner, Staten Island. His New York City reached a $5.9 million settlement in 2015 with his family after he died after being put in a police chokehold. We all remember seeing the video of that. So the $3 million, it does fall right in the middle there. The largest settlement I could find was LaTanya Haggerty in Chicago. She was chased by police. She was a passenger in a car that was chased by police in 1999. This goes back to 1999. All right. It took till 2001, a few years later, to settle that wrongful death suit. $18 million went to her family after she was shot to death by an officer when she was a passenger in a car that was being chased by police. In that case, the officer, by the way, was also black, said he mistook the shiny object in Haggerty's hand for a weapon. Her family got $18 million. It is 3:31. I'm Jordana Green. We are going to change it up a little bit. We're going to talk about the Supreme Court's big day with David Schultz in a moment.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Travel bans, wedding cakes, playground services. Boy, the Supreme Court has been very, very busy today on this last day before they get to take their summer vacation. Maybe I should have been a Supreme Court justice. Then I could take a summer vacation, too. The other big story of the day, of course, is that the Supreme Court is allowing the Trump administration to go forward with a limited version of the ban on travel from the six mostly Muslim countries. President Donald Trump says this is a clear victory. Other people say it just sort of narrows the restrictions on the original ban. Joining us now is Dave Schultz. He's a political science professor at Hamline to shake out what's going on at the Supreme Court and how that will affect you and me. Professor Schultz, always happy to have you on the show.
Great to be on again, Jordana.
Let's start with the travel ban, because that's the big talker of the day. Now, it's my understanding that the changes are the ban, a limited ban is in place. And unless you have either family or a job connection here, then you're banned. But if you have those two, you can still come. Is that about right?
That's correct. The Supreme Court said that if you have if you're a foreign national, you have some kind of connection to the United States, such as family or job, as you said, you will be allowed to be come into the United States. And so this does, or at least apply for it. Okay. This does narrow the Trump travel ban quite a bit. But I think it's important to think about here is that generally the court doesn't issue or doesn't lift stays like this, unless it thinks you're more likely than not to win on the merits. And so when Trump has sort of announced today and said big win for him, may not be a big win, but it's certainly in, right now, but it's certainly indicating that, he may win eventually some limited version of his ban before the Supreme Court when they hear arguments next October.
Now, when this all shook out, a federal judge blocked the ban 8 days after it was put in place. That was upheld by a Ninth Circuit panel. Then a fourth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond, Virginia, said the ban was rooted in religious animus and that it was unconstitutional. So how is it now constitutional?
Well, that's a good question. First off, remember that the lower courts never actually ruled on the merits. They issued injunctions to halt its enforcement pending it being argued on the merits. And so what the court did today was to, this is really quite technical, it lifted that temporary ban on enforcement of that travel order that Trump put into place. We still don't have a really ruling on the merits regarding whether or not it's constitutional. That's what we're going to get in October. And so the lower courts, in anticipating and thinking that it would be unconstitutional, issued the travel bans or injunctions.
All right. So nothing. Does anything change before October?
A little bit, yes. Trump will be able to go ahead with a limited version of the travel ban. But the Supreme Court also indicated that by the time it gets to be October, it might not hear the case because it said that Trump talked about wanting to have a temporary ban. And so depending on where that temporary ban is come October, the court may say, well, if the temporary ban is expired, we're not going to listen to this case. So this is kind of like, stay tuned to see what happens next.
All right. There's a couple of other cases that I wanted to get to. Obviously, that was the big one. The Supreme Court agreed to take up the Colorado gay wedding case. So this happened, I believe, in 2013 at Masterpiece Cake Shop in Denver. They, the owner of the cake shop said, I don't want to bake a wedding cake for certain clients because they're gay. And now the Supreme Court, they've just decided to listen to the case. Is that what happened today?
Yes, correct. Correct. And what this case is going to hinge on is a couple of different things. You know, one of them is that the 1964 Civil Rights Act bans public accommodation, which basically means businesses from that engage in interstate commerce, from discriminating against people on a variety of different counts. Now, the original act never actually mentioned gender orientation or sexual preference. Mm-hmm. And so one of the questions is going to be whether or not the Supreme Court will interpret the 64 Civil Rights Act to include also sexual orientation or preference. And then two, if so, will it extend so far as to say that somebody who's in the business of baking wedding cakes would be prevented from discriminating on that that purpose. And so so that's kind of an interesting case because in general what the 64 Civil Rights Act says is that, again, any public accommodation, effectively any public accommodation, that's a term of art that means any business that discriminates in hiring or against customers based upon, as we know now, race, nationality. The original language of the 64 Civil Rights Act used the word sex, not gender, or sex. That would be illegal. So the question is now, will this also apply to, again, people who are gay and lesbian? And with that, will it extend to refusing to provide services?
He also, the cake shop owner, says his rights of religion and free speech were violated. So how did those play in then, other than the Civil Rights Act?
Correct. And the argument's going to be whether or not this person has a free exercise of religion to be able to refuse to provide services, to gays and lesbians, or is it hurting his free speech? I would argue that similar arguments like this were raised back in the 1960s when the act went into place, when people claimed that it would be against their religion or against their free speech rights if they were required to service people who are African American. Not quite on scores we're citing today, but something similar, and the courts ruled against them. And so this is going to be interesting to see in terms of how this court will take some of that sort of history of the Civil Rights Act and now apply that with these, you know, with these claims being raised here to discrimination claims.
Wow. I mean, religion, speech, civil rights, this case sort of has all of these elements. And Professor Schultz, I don't want to put you on the spot here, but how do you think this one is going to shake out?
Boy, this is all
put on your justice hat. Come on. Give me an idea.
Okay. I mean, part of it's going to be whether or not Justice Kennedy stays on the court. If Justice Kennedy stays on the court, and there's rumors he might resign, then I think it's going to be 5-4 and the wedding cake person loses. If Justice Kennedy is replaced by another Trump appointee, I think it's going to be 5-4 the other direction. And so I think a lot of it just hangs on where Justice Kennedy is and what's going to happen. And again, the rumors are that he may step down and retire after being on the bench since, 1988, almost 30 years.
That's fascinating. There's another one I want to get your opinion on before we have to go to break. The Supreme Court ruled today that a Missouri church was wrongly denied a state grant when they wanted money. They wanted a grant to refinish their playground surface. Okay.
Right.
They were denied that grant, citing separation of church and state. Well, you're a church, so you can't have state money because you're a religious organization. Well, the court ruled today that Missouri was wrong to deny Trinity Lutheran a grant simply because that it's a church. The justices said Trinity Lutheran was illegally excluded from an otherwise neutral public benefit to resurface the school's playground. How is this not a separation of church and state?
Well, it should be, except if one looks at, again, whether or not I agree with the decision is a different story entirely. Mm-hmm. But if I look at the precedents that are out there, for example, look at situations where Minnesota, among other states, for example, gives a tax exemption to religious property, you know, for churches and so forth. And the way that the court has said that they can, that is, the state can do that is by saying that if churches are part of a larger group of nonprofits or entities that qualify under certain neutral criteria for tax exemption, they're entitled to do so. That's exactly what the court said here today also, is that if there's neutral criteria that makes money available for grants or money to replace certain types of playground surfaces, to now single out a particular group because they are a church would be discrimination based upon denial of the free exercise of religion. Now, there's a whole other train of precedents out there that would suggest they could have reached a different reasoning on this one, but that would be the train of precedents that they relied upon in terms of saying that this church was just no different than anybody else who could have neutrally applied for that grant.
I have to ask if you agree.
I don't agree.
Tell us why.
I don't agree. I'm actually one of those people who believe that the high wall of separation, also believe that that once you start to have these entanglements, what we wind up doing here is we now give the government the ability to what? To tell that church when they apply for the money, you know, what kind of playground they have to have, how they have to do a variety of different things in terms of providing services, et cetera, et cetera. We start to have the government stick its nose into the church's business. And I think we oftentimes are worried about church influence on the state. I think we ought to be equally worried about the fact that when the government starts to now provide resources to churches, it now has more temples and synagogues. It has more ability to tell those institutions what they have to do also. So
slippery slope.
I think it's a dangerous precedent.
Wow. I'm glad I asked all of those questions. And boy, I'm glad we got those three cases in such a short time. Dave Schultz, you're such a pro. He's a professor of political science at Hamline, of course, as you know him, an astronomer and just all around great guy. So I'm so glad that you have made time for us today.
No problem, Jordana. Anytime.
You got it. Thank you, sir. Boy, news filled hour right there. Jordana Green, thanks for hanging with me a little bit. I only have a minute or two with you, but boy, we broke down the Castile settlement and then three cases in front of the Supreme Court. Interesting rulings with Dave Schultz. Somebody asked this question. Hey, Jor, this is a serious question. I like when you preface it that way. You're not messing with me. Would the law apply to a Jewish delicatessen? If a customer wanted a sandwich made with some kind of pork, would the delicatessen be forced to sell him that sandwich or a halal market? Well, I'll tell you what I know about Jewish delis. A Jewish delicatessen would never stock a pork product, so they wouldn't have it. That's like, you know, going into a pizza shop and wanting a steak. They can't serve it to you because they don't have it. It doesn't exist. So they cannot. So they wouldn't be forced. I'll tell you something else. Also, in a Jewish deli, you don't mix meat and milk. So if someone goes in and asks for, you know, a turkey sandwich with cheese, it's not possible to give you that because they don't have it, because we don't mix meat and milk. And often a Jewish deli doesn't even carry any dairy. They don't have anything made with milk to observe the laws of kashrut, to keep kosher. So that, you know, they couldn't be forced to because they don't carry it. I have zero expertise on halal markets, but I also, because I don't believe they eat pork, they would never stock that. They wouldn't have it near them. They wouldn't. It just wouldn't exist in their coffers. So they would not be able to serve it to you. So that's sort of how that works. They would have to serve anybody who walked in, you know, blue, green, black, white, you know, gay, straight, whatever, you know, any kind of sandwich, according to the law. But they would not be able to serve you a Reuben or a Rachel because they don't mix milk and meat and certainly wouldn't have any pork there. I hope that answers your question. We're about out of time. Frank Vassalero is coming up next, and we will also go beyond the headlines at 4:35. Lots of big news today. The news is up next here on WCCO.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.